Engage for Success Radio, raising the profile of employee engagement and shining a light on good practice for people who believe there's a better way to work.
Good afternoon. I'm Jo Dodds, your host for today. It feels like I haven't been here for ages. I guess it must have been with the summer and bank holidays and the like. So I'm a social media HR consultant working with the Engage for Success movement, leading on digital and social media. The Engage for Success movement is an inclusive movement committed to the idea that there's a better way to work by releasing more of the capability and potential of people at work. We spread the word about employee engagement and shine a light on good practice, and we're widely supported across the UK involving the public, private and third sectors. If you go to our website, engageforsuccess.org, you can use the orange button in the top right to join in, get onto our mailing list. We are now sending a weekly short newsletter to keep people up to speed on what's happening, including what's happening on the radio show and also with events. And Kathy's generally writing a little note each week about what's happening within the movement as well. So go to the website, click on the orange button in the top right, and you can get onto that list. If you tweet, please share your thoughts using our hashtag, which is #E4S with the number 4, and join in our LinkedIn groups. And we also have a Yammer group. If you go to engageforsuccess.org/Yammer, then you'll be able to request an invite to get into the network. All the social media links are on the homepage on the right sidebar under Connect with Us. And if you enjoy our shows and regularly listen, please take the time to go to our iTunes profile and give us a rating. That'd be really helpful. So today I'm interviewing Amy Brann of Synaptic Potential. She's the author of Engage, the Neuroscience Behind Creating Productive People in Successful Organizations. And today we're going to be talking about the neuroscience of engagement. So welcome, Amy. Great to have you with us.
You too, Jo. Thank you for allowing me to be part of this movement, which is just amazing.
So tell us a bit about you, and crucially for this science-based conversation, about your credentials, where you've come from, what you've done, and that sort of thing.
Oh, well, I started, I guess, studying people, studying the brain, studying quantum physics when I was about 15 years old, and was just really fascinated by how we work and what we knew that we didn't know we knew. So unless you actually sought out the information, it wasn't what they were being pumped out at school, but it was fascinating what information was out there. I'd known from a young age that I wanted to go to medical school, that I wanted to be a doctor, so I headed off to UCL Medical School, and there I was fascinated by the body, but more fascinated by the mind and the brain, and realized that at that point I was disappointed by psychiatry, and I thought that we weren't curing people, we weren't enabling people to live freer lives with mental health challenges in the way that I perhaps had naively believed we could be. And so started looking at other disciplines to help people live more fulfilling lives, and came across coaching, of all things, to start with, and then started realizing that there was a whole world of business out there outside of this medical focus that I'd always had, and so left medical school without a degree. So I'm, from that perspective, very unqualified, but studied to be a coach and set up a coaching organization, and was always going back to the science to underpin everything and to understand more, well, how did this tool work and what was actually going on in people's brains when we took them through this process and when we were wanting to enable changes. And that carried on for about 6 years working with individuals, and then I transitioned more into working with organizations. It just sort of happened organically, and we found that we were able to make in some ways more of an impact by going in and actually working with the organizations. And as things have progressed over the years, we've continued to very much be guided by the research, but also partner with other organizations. Like, our company worked with the Center for Behavior Change at one of the UK-based universities, and through that we could really see the impact that behavioral science had when blended with neuroscience. So within the multidisciplinary team, there were neuroscientists, behavioral science experts, psychologists, and all had often different ways of describing things and different journeys that have brought them to the point that they were then at in their careers. But when you got everyone in a room together and you could talk about a problem that an organization was having, then the different insights brought together were really incredible and really powerful.
So how did you then come to be writing a book called Engage the Neuroscience Behind Creating Productive People in Successful Organizations? It's quite a lengthy title. I guess it sort of speaks to some of what you do, but not everybody writes a book on what they do as a consultant. So how did that all come about?
I guess the book journey started 3 years ago. So when we were having conversations with organizations, we were finding that when you start mentioning neuroscience, leaders or HR directors can say, oh, neuroscience, where does that fit in? I thought that maybe they'd heard of it as a scientific discipline but didn't know of any applications to businesses. Nowadays, obviously, I think things are quite different, and when we speak to groups and say, well, you know, how many people within your organization have a brain, and they laugh and say, well, some of them, then it's obvious that there are potential applications, and I think sometimes those applications are not translated credibly or thoroughly, making them less helpful, but I think there are certainly amazing insights that can be taken from the field and applied to many areas of business, many areas of organization. And when I was, so this is the third book I've written. The first one we sort of sought out the opportunity for, the second one came to us, and this one also came to us and became the way it sort of became our focus on engagement was through the research. So looking at the neuroscience and chunking up, as we often do, to try and see themes and see how we could then translate it and apply it so organizations can use it. And when I kept mulling around all the different areas of research and all of the different concepts that we were coming out with, I was thinking, what does this actually give people? And I think it gives people engagement. And we think of it in terms of engaged brains, but it's I think that's how we got to this point. We ultimately want to equip people with the building blocks from a brain perspective to create these organizations where people can most easily feel excited on Monday mornings and fulfilled on Friday afternoons, I think similar to the movement.
I came across a short video clip on your website when I was preparing for today, and you talked about organizations mostly focusing on managing people, but from a neuroscience point of view, you were saying you get more rewards by focusing on engagement rather than the managing bit. Why is that?
Oh, so managing people tends to, and not across the board, but tends to be associated with rules, regulations, telling people what to do, boxes to tick, moving this way, moving that way, control. And it tends to result in quite negative practices that end up decreasing the opportunities for a person's brain to be engaged. So the state of engagement from a brain perspective tends to be much more positive and put someone in a state, a place with brain chemistry and brain activation that would lead to more of the behaviors that we want to see within an organization. And I think some organizations are really clear on what they want, but then the ways that they're organizing themselves and the practices that they've got in place and the policies and the procedures can really diminish those opportunities to engage brains.
So what is employee engagement from your perspective? How would you describe it?
All about engaged brains. So I would take a step back and think about the different scenarios where we naturally see people engaged. So it might be a child playing with her favorite toy, making up stories about the adventures it's been on, or a teenager heading out of the door with his skateboard for the fourth time that day to practice his 360-degree flips, or volunteers at a local food festival where I was this weekend, volunteering their time and doing everything that needs to be done just from a really self-motivated place. They're not being managed, they're being enabled, and they're totally engaged, and the results that you get from them are just incredible. So I know that there are lots of definitions around there about engagement, and I'm not, whether it's an attitude, a behavior, an outcome, I'm not here to propose an answer to that. There are people far more expert than I, but I think the qualities that we normally attribute to engagement, like heightened emotional connection, able to influence, exert greater discretional effect, commitment, willingness to help out, that it's something that's offered rather than required. I think those things you see in many different situations. I think there's many ways the brain can be engaged, but ultimately we'd be looking to activate reward networks within the brain. And when we do that, then people experience an increase in cognitive resources, which is a great thing. They're more creative. They can solve more problems using insight. They've got a broader field of view. They can have more action-focused ideas. So it can be a really great place to be when these reward networks are activated within the brain and people are engaged.
So are you saying that extrinsic reward is less effective? So we're saying it's all happening in the brain, or are we saying that if there are things outside of the brain that make you feel good, then that is helpful too?
Great question. Really great question. You know, intrinsic versus extrinsic. Ultimately, everything has to, in some way, engage the brain intrinsically. So whatever's going on in the outside world needs to have an internal effect in order for it to have an effect. So if you're offering me, you know, £10, but I don't know what pounds is, you know, it's got absolutely no value to me. Perhaps, you know, I'm from another country and I've got just no idea what the value of £10 is, then that probably wouldn't light up my reward networks internally, and so I wouldn't be motivated or I wouldn't be engaged in whatever it is you were then asking me to do. However, if there was something that externally was rewarding to me, for example, you know, volunteering, it may seem like a selfless thing to do, and it may be that people were miserable throughout that experience at this food festival, and they may have been hating every minute of it, or it may be that they felt really good about themselves and they enjoyed the atmosphere, and there were extrinsic triggers that lit up their internal reward systems. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yeah, thank you. So we talk quite often when we are within the movement and quite often on the radio show about the four enablers of engagement, which David and Nita identified as existing in all the organisations where they found strong employee engagement. So it's not a model or something that's sort of prescriptive, but it's something that was there. And so we use it as a sort of a framework to articulate what we're talking about when we talk about strong engagement. So are there any neuroscientific links to the enablers? And the enablers are strong strategic narrative, engaging managers, employee voice, and organizational integrity.
Yes, I think they're wonderful. And I've seen similar things in some great organizations. So the first one you mentioned, this strong strategic narrative, I think when an organization has got that, you can see congruency through the leadership to the rest of the organization. And that's really important for fostering trust. And trust has got numerous, we call them neural correlates, so things that are going on in the brain that we can see when someone's going through a process of either trusting someone or being trusted or acting in a trustworthy way. But ultimately, to sort of chunk up, I think this congruency and this trust is really key from a brain perspective to create an environment where it's easy to be engaged, and parallels the observational research that's been done and that you guys are seeing. I think having a vision that people can connect with and can see actually the future and actually have it in their mind. What does this future look like? I remember one organization we worked with where I asked a big room full of people that were very disengaged at this point in time, as we often get brought in at that point, whether I was painting a picture. I was saying, well, you know, I know things are really bad right now, but you know what the future looks like. You know what your leaders are working towards and why they're driving these things, because the future looks good, right? You've got a picture of where you're going. And they all went quiet, and I said, well, you do have a vision, this sort of, some sort of idea of where things are going to be in 5 years, and one guy in the whole room of about 250 people who it transpires was the marketing guy said yes, I think I could explain it, but he was the only one, and it was just awful from that perspective. And so for the rest of them, they were being asked to change, but they had no idea where they fitted in, what the metaphor was for the organization, and where things were heading. So I completely agree that it's important. You must have seen similar things.
Yeah, and it's that whole thing that about every individual being able to see, having a direct line of sight between what they're doing on a daily basis and what that strategic narrative is. And so it's partly about knowing what it is. It's then about knowing what their part is in it. And you can see, I mean, just on the top level without any scientific knowledge or experience, you could see why that would be completely demotivating for people, not knowing what the company's doing, or then knowing what the company's doing but not knowing what their part is in that.
Absolutely. You know, you see it even with something as basic with children about building a toy or building a model. You know, it's much easier to start grabbing the Duplo pieces and putting them together in something that resembles a princess castle if you can see what it's supposed to look like. Otherwise, it can be really quite challenging to get started if all you've got is a big pile of bricks and no idea of what you're trying to build. So I would agree with that.
Yeah.
On to the next one, there's engaging managers.
One of the roles of the manager is to ensure that the individuals have that line of sight between what they're doing and that strategic narrative. So where does the engaging managers piece fit with the neuroscientific links?
I think there's a real opportunity to, as you mentioned, coach and stretch people, but to give people control. So one of the insights from neuroscience is that people having a sense of control over what they're doing, their work, you know, how they contribute to the bigger picture is really important and activates reward networks rather than threat networks. The other piece that I think is really important is this connection piece. There's lots of research that shows that we are social beings, and being connected to other people helps to activate the reward networks rather than putting us in physical and eventually negative health situations through a lack of connection. So is this manager someone that they can relate to and connect with and feel that they can trust and feel that they can work effectively with? And with their manager stretching them, then that stretch piece enables people more easily to get into the state of flow. And there's a lot of emerging neuroscience around this state of flow and how, and different neuroscientists have got different sort of frames around it, different networks that are activated within the brain. But essentially, it can be a great space to work from, a great state to be in, and typically we associate it with sport or music. But it's possible to get into flow in work as well. And if more people were enabled to do that, possibly through great management, then it would transform our working world.
And the third enabler, obviously, I mean, I was going to say links to that, but they all link together, not surprisingly.
They do, yeah.
But, you know, part of that relationship with the managers and the employees is around enabling employee voice. How does that work from a neuroscience perspective?
I think links here are, again, around control and feeling that what they say is worthwhile. So there's almost a value piece and a fairness piece. If you work for an organization that's saying, we want your time, we want your resources, we want your knowledge, we want your skills, but we don't want to listen to you, then there's a real incongruence there, and there's really mixed messages, and the brain doesn't like mixed messages at all. It's very inefficient for it to, if there are multiple different lines of communication coming in that then can't be assimilated into one message, then that's quite it's quite challenging and reduces the efficiency of the brain. So we want things to be streamlined, and if we're saying that we value employees, but then we're not listening to them, from a logical perspective, we can see that that doesn't make any sense.
And it's that thing about just asking questions, it doesn't demonstrate listening, as in, you know, you can ask questions, get answers, and then ignore the answers, and that hasn't really made any difference other than in a negative way.
Yes, in a negative way, absolutely. Surveys that are sent out, or focus groups that are set up that then actually do not listen or respond or in quite important ways respond to what's coming out of it can be really detrimental, as you said.
Mm-hmm. And then the fourth enabler is all around organisational integrity. How does that fit with the neuroscience?
This is really our congruency piece here. If we don't have integrity, if we don't have clearness within the channels, the clarity within the channels, then the brain can pick up on this and interpret it as unfairness, untrustworthiness, and that makes it an undesirable place to work. And when we think about how our brains evolved and how we used to be very much part of tribes, this is similar. You know, our place of work can be like our tribe, and if we're not then feeling like we can trust and respect and feel safe with the people around us, it makes sense that our brain would react unfavorably to that, and then time and energy is being diverted to dealing with that and making sense of that and processing that rather than getting on with the job that we want to be there doing.
Mm-hmm. And I think when that goes wrong often in organizations is where the managers think that they're doing all the things they should be doing and that it is all wonderful. And everybody else knows that it isn't. And,
absolutely.
You sometimes wonder why they've not picked that one up.
Absolutely, and it's awful when you see that in organisations where leaders have got a very low self awareness level, and in some organisations we've worked with, they've even been told this isn't working, and their response is to shut down. And I think that comes back to investing in engagement from a stage before things go wrong. So I'm sure similarly you sometimes see organizations when they're in need of help, they're going through changes and there's low resilience and all of these challenges, but that's really the least ideal time to be shaping an organization and investing in it. It's much better to be doing it when there's not these acute wounds within an organization. So that's why one of the reasons the movement's so great is really raising the profile of engagement and what can be done from an early stage.
Yeah. So what do you see as the biggest obstacles to engagement in organizations that you're working with?
I think linked to one of the points you mentioned earlier, for us we call it contribution based on the research, but when the contribution's not clearly articulated, so often when you ask a leader, what do they do? Or you ask someone within an organization, what do they do? You get a very transactional, very title, job title-based response. And that actually doesn't activate the reward networks within individuals, whereas if you're able to share something passionately and clearly and as if you're talking to a three-year-old, so a three-year-old could understand what it is you actually do and what value it and offers the world and what contribution is that a person's making, then that's far more powerful. Imagine you're at a dinner party and you actually want to keep talking to this person. When they ask you, what do you do, what could you say that actually a person would go, oh, wow, that's interesting, that's nice. I remember the first time I met with David James at Disney, and he said to me, I'm lucky. He said, I just have to say I work for Disney and people are captivated and interested. And a lot of organizations don't have that kind of pull. You know, we work with construction companies and they say, you know, I mix concrete. That's how do I make that sound like it's contributing something? But when you chunk up and you actually look at, well, what that actually does and what value that brings people, I've not yet come across a scenario where the contribution can't be clearly articulated. So that would be the first thing. And the second would be this leadership congruency that we've touched on. So, you know, why aren't the leaders here when we're going through some learning and development intervention? Why we don't respect the leaders? I think that can be really damaging. And then the third would probably be this environmental negative nudging. So it happens mostly under the radar. But I think with the new excitement around doing L&D, having things 70-20-10 friendly, is great. But the KPI and the rewards encourage formal learning, for example. And you've then got this environmental negative nudging that's saying you want people to do one thing, but actually the environment is pushing people in a different direction. And I think that can be really damaging. And last week, actually, at Learning Live, I heard Mark from Tesco Bank talking, and he was talking about not creating L&D strategies, but focusing on the business strategy and working from there. And it makes total sense, but apparently it was quite revolutionary to actually have that level of congruency and then cascade from there, which I guess combined with an awareness of all of the ways that we can behaviorally nudge people would be quite a sound way of eradicating that obstacle.
So was that saying that in some ways we focus too much on sort of identifying learning and development for people sort of for the sake of it rather than because it's needed for the business, and then that's made it something that's less valuable within the organisation and perhaps then impacted on the engagement?
Absolutely. There's definitely examples of that occurring, and I think one of the things I see is people following trends rather than actually having a grounding, foundational understanding of what the business needs and so then what you're doing to equip people. And I think sometimes this scattergun approach can be really damaging.
Yeah, and it's a bit like the next big thing, or a bit like when people talk about putting in an employee engagement program. And, you know, I remember one of us being told once that an organisation had put their program on hold because they were going through some restructuring, and it was a bit like, I don't think you quite get the point. So, interesting that these things get sort of packaged up and sort of used as a thing rather than being about how you do stuff around here, sort of thing.
Absolutely. No, I was just going to say, linked to that, one of the insights that was shared last week was a hatred of interventions. You know, learning happens all the time in organisations, just like engagement. It's all, you know, you're either engaging or disengaging, I think.
Yeah.
And you can get away with some disengaging as long as you've got really strong engaging. But it's something that's constantly going on in an organisation, which links to lots of things.
There's probably a whole other show about exactly that and how people sort of fight those things when they see them as being things that are being done to them rather than, as you say, just being part of how things
absolutely,
you know, need to happen. Yeah. So just quickly, the last question is, you one of the chapters in your book is called Are You Capitalising on a Neuro-Friendly Culture? What does that mean?
Well, it's exactly what we're talking about, this sort of pervasive, continuous investment in engagement. So, you know, the cultures are hugely powerful influences on thinking, our internal environment, our behaviors, our results. And from the neuroscience, we see that the metaphor, the story, the dialogue, there's lots of different terms for it, that an organization is sharing is really key to shaping a culture. Trust as a foundation is just so powerful. You know, the release of oxytocin, the effects on the amygdala, there's lots of research that says trust is really important. And then fairness and connection, two other points that we've scratched the surface of. But without these, then you just see really real challenges from a cultural perspective. So I do think that there are brain-friendly, neuro-friendly cultural pieces that any organization could take into consideration when they're looking to strengthen their culture. And there are some amazing companies out there doing great work, like Favi, the technical company, trusts teams with their overall reality of what's going on there. So their work becomes more of an adventure than a bind, and they do quirky things like the teams decide budgets for projects rather than haggling with a boss, and they don't come in with inflated numbers. They're honest about their needs, and I just think it's fantastic that there are organisations creating great examples.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you so much, Amy. Before we started, it goes by in a flash, and we really are at the end of the show, so thank you for joining us. It's been really helpful.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Just to let listeners know, next week Jo Moffat will be back and she'll be interviewing Tom Morell, who's chair of our London Region Champions Group, amongst other accolades, about his experience in the world of employee engagement through 33 years in the Met to his current role as a trainer, executive coach and visiting lecturer at Kingston University. So join us same time next week.
Engage for Success Radio, raising the profile of employee engagement and shining a light on good practice for people who believe there's a better way to work.